Welcome back to the Business of Government Magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Vice Admiral Mark Harnachek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency, is charged with providing full-spectrum logistical support to the armed services and civilians around the world, every day, and for every major conflict over the past five decades.
Conceived back in the 60s as sort of a more efficient way to supply the services with the logistics needs that, you know, they all need that are common to all of them. So stood up back in the early 60s, and we've evolved over time to support all of the traditional supply chains that any military or, frankly, civilian logistician would sort of know and understand. So, you know, items like food, medicines, medical surgical equipment, fuel is one of our big supply chains, construction equipment, construction supplies, uniforms, and all the things that our service people sort of wear on their person or use out in the field, and then repair parts for, you know, land systems, maritime systems, and air systems. So really the whole range of logistics items, and we manage them sort of cradle to grave. So we sell them, truly sell them to our service customers, and they reimburse us, which goes right back into our working capital fund to buy the next thing that we need. So it's a really a simple funding mechanism. I mean, even a guy like me who's not an accountant or knows nothing about business can easily understand that.
Logistics is a cost driver that must be managed with deliberate precision. Since Admiral Harnachek arrived at DLA, he's focused on significantly improving its performance while dramatically reducing its cost. It's all about putting DLA's customers first and being warfighter-focused, globally responsive, and most of all, fiscally responsible supply chain leaders.
We're going to significantly improve performance, and performance as defined by our customers, whoever they are, while we dramatically reduce cost. We have two big cost centers. We have the cost of the stuff we buy, and then we have our operating costs. So we're going to take a big crack at that. We've coined a little phrase here, 13 and 6. That's $13 billion over the next 6 years. So what that means to folks that really don't understand a lot of working capital fund accounting mumbo jumbo, that means between now and 6 years from now, DLA will deliver improved performance at $13 billion less cost. So that means our customers will get equal to or improved cost, but they'll be paying a lot less for it.
DLA has sought to reduce its cost by substantially increasing its reverse auction opportunities, which has led to savings of more than $1.6 billion. Vice Admiral Harnachek explains.
A big one that I learned back in my Navy days was something called a reverse auction. Well, this is a pricing tool that we use for qualified suppliers, and that's the pricing. So instead of a sealed bid or a best and final that we negotiate with each of the suppliers, this runs just like it's an online auction. We do it for virtually anything that is more than $100,000. So goods, services, fuel, medicine, all that stuff. So the folks in the auction, and you only need two to have an auction. Very often we have more than two, three to five to six, and we run it just like a regular auction. So we have a sort of a target where we want to start, and the suppliers bid against one another. So unbeknownst to us, there's all sorts of deliberations going on in their boardrooms with regard to how low they can actually get. Mm-hmm. So what it does is it lets everybody else see everybody else's sort of margin and how low can you go. And again, our rule to start with was that any buy that was over $100,000, we were going to subject that to a reverse auction. Over the past year, we've done over 5,000 reverse auctions. No kidding, auditable, no kidding savings. We're at about $1.8 billion.
DLA is working aggressively to keep counterfeit parts out of the military supply chain and working closely with manufacturers to find innovative ways of proving product authenticity. Admiral Harnachek explains.
There is an entire industry in the Far East that counterfeits parts. Mm-hmm. They rip apart old components. They get something that looks like what it is that we want. They mark it, and then it makes it into this sort of aftermarket. And you've read stories periodically about, you know, a bad component making it to a missile system, to an air mobility command airplane, to a submarine, to a ship. And these are components that are used. They're not very expensive in and of themselves, but they go in higher assemblies that really sort of decide which way the rocket goes or which way the ship goes. So we take that very seriously. Probably the commodity that is most at risk or most susceptible to counterfeiting are microcircuits. Mm. So each microcircuit that you'll see and open up a piece of electronics at home, your stereo, your cell phone, or whatever, that'll have a microcircuit on it, and every microcircuit has an inked marking. So for all DLA-managed microcircuits, we are impregnating that ink with plant DNA. And again, you don't have to be a PhD to determine it. You get one of those little lights that TSA uses. You shine it on the ink, and if it doesn't flash a certain color, it's not a good component. So we're doing that, I want to say, with probably 25 to 35 of our microcircuit manufacturers, and we've had a healthy discussion with the microcircuit manufacturers over whether that's a good idea or not. But as the guy that's responsible for good components in the supply chain, this is not a fail-safe method, but I feel a whole lot better about the goodness of our microcircuits. If they flow through a system that either keeps them out to begin with, and the final fail-safe is, does it have that DNA mark? And of course, anybody with a light can be a counterfeit tester. Sure. So we started that about a year ago, and it's been pretty successful. So, and of course, we will expand that to other commodities as well. And again, this is not something we thought of. The cosmetic and the handbag industry has been doing this. Of course, counterfeits and knockoffs has been the bane of their existence. So this is a technology that they have used to great effect with lipstick and handbags and all that sort of stuff.
With some 1 million veterans likely to separate or retire in the next 5 years, and many young veterans unemployed, Curtis Coy, Deputy Undersecretary for Economic Opportunity with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, discusses how VA promotes employment and educational opportunities for veterans.
What's interesting, Michael, is that my office was created in 2011, and it was created principally to consolidate a number of different programs that have economic opportunity written all over them. So, for example, in my purview, I have all things GI Bill, or education for veterans. We also have the Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Service for wounded warriors and disabled veterans. We have the VA Home Loan Program, and as well things dealing with veteran employment and those issues as they relate to what we're doing today. And so the office, we like to think we have a pretty significant mission. We enable veterans to attain personal and economic success. And we do this through the foundations for veterans to succeed through the policies and programs that we have and the ones that I just mentioned. So we view the veteran relationship that we have with our veterans as active partners, and we're both accountable. So our portfolio benefits and services are designed to enable both personal and economic success.
COI manages a portfolio of educational and job training services for eligible veterans to enhance their economic opportunity and successful transition.
We've created three very specific strategic goals for the Office of Economic Opportunity. The first one is promote employment opportunities for veterans. Pretty simple, straightforward. The second is enhance opportunities for veterans to obtain knowledge and skills. And then finally, provide opportunities for veterans to obtain, retain, and adopt a home. There's lots of programs that revolve around those things. And we like to think that we help ensure that we build the foundation for veterans to succeed through those kinds of programs and policies that we have. For example, through our education and employment programs, GI Bill, Vet Success on Campus, VRE, we want to ensure that we're empowering veterans with those knowledge and skills and opportunities they need to succeed in the 21st century. So we want to make sure that veterans are truly informed consumers as they go forward. It's not always that we do for veterans, rather that we make sure that they understand the benefits that they're entitled to.
The post-9/11 GI Bill is arguably one of the most extensive educational authorizations since the original Montgomery GI Bill in 1944. In the last 4 years alone, VA paid $35 billion in post-9/11 GI Bill benefits to about 1 million beneficiaries.
So we've had about 4 years or so of using it. And as I mentioned earlier, we've spent about $35 billion and served about 1 million beneficiaries. The post-9/11 GI Bill is a comprehensive educational benefit. It's broken into basically three pieces. One is tuition. We pay for the veterans' tuition. Specifically, we pay for the veterans' tuition at public schools, whatever that tuition is, and then there's some restrictions with private schools. We also provide up to $1,000 for book stipend for veterans as they go through this, and then finally a housing stipend. That housing stipend is whatever the housing allowance is for a married E5 in that particular area. And so combining those three things, tuition veterans don't have to worry about, books veterans shouldn't have to worry about, and having a housing stipend such that they can live and pay their bills and focus on schools is critically important. So this post-9/11 GI Bill is worth 36 months of benefits, and veterans have up to 15 years to use it. So it's a pretty comprehensive benefit. And so what it allows for is it increases that accessibility to higher education for veterans and their dependents, by the way. One unique aspect of this post-9/11 GI Bill is that veterans can provide some of those 36 months of benefits to their spouses and or dependents. They have to make that election while they're still in the service. The GI Bill has never been available to beneficiaries other than the veteran themselves. So that's another key aspect of it.
Kurt Coy, Deputy Undersecretary for Economic Opportunity with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, underscores why hiring a veteran makes good business sense.
And it's one that I spend a lot of time on, not only speaking to constituent groups, but also speaking to employers. And whenever I talk to them about hiring veterans, the first thing I say to them is, hiring a veteran makes good business sense. And then I go into explaining why it makes good business sense. The military experience that veterans bring to the workforce makes them resilient, motivated to succeed, dependable, and reliable. Billions of dollars have been invested in training of this specifically post-9/11 generation of veterans, and it's one of the most tech-savvy and broadly skilled military forces in the world. Think about all of these veterans and the amount of tools that they've used in the military, and they're now coming into the workforce. Veterans, I tell them, are a good investment. Employers who have established hiring practices that seek veterans are not disappointed. They're never disappointed, and they continue to hire more. For example, we just released a hiring guide that we helped develop for employers to help connect with military talent.
Next up, Insights from Leaders, when this special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns.